Hey guys, so before we get going today, I wanted to just kind of alert everybody, especially if you're part of the home crowd here, if this is your church, man, be lifting up today our college students. They are on their fall retreat. I got a chance to be there yesterday, and I'm going to tell you one of the most exciting things that we have going as a church. If you could have been there when I was there Saturday night, you just would have been fueled, I mean, to continue to pour out and to pour into these students and to be a part of what's going on here. I don't know how many students were there. It had to have been, with leaders and everything, 150 people probably in the room that are up there in the mountains. And the cool thing was there was seven colleges and universities that were represented at the retreat. So all around, I mean, just a very diverse crowd, a lot of things going on with the different colleges here. So if you're part of the church here, I just wanted to encourage everybody at both campuses, man, let's lift them up. As I'm speaking right now, they're doing their last session. And I just think, man, when I see our students, I just think, man, what is God going to do in the next generation? All we hear about is doomsday stuff for the church, and then you see this, and I'm like, no. The kingdom is just roaring. It is advancing, and it is going with these guys. They're going to do things that we never thought to do. So I hope you guys will join me in prayer. All right, if you have a copy of scripture, I want you to take it out and turn with me to Genesis 1. Again, no surprise, okay? We are going to do one verse from Genesis 2 today, so we are making some headway as we continue to move, but we're going to be looking at the end part of Genesis 1 again. If you're new today, we've been in a series called In the Beginning, and it's about the beginning, okay? It's us looking at the first three chapters of the book of Genesis to understand God's intentions for the world. And what we have learned through this series is that all of us kind of feel the destination that we're on. And what I mean by that is we all sort of feel meaning. We feel like our life matters. We feel like we're not just a bunch of complicated stardust. I mean, we feel this. But if we feel the destination, if we have lost, though, the starting place, if we have been cut off from it through philosophy or scientific theory that's branded as fact, whatever it is that cuts us off from the starting place, if we feel the destination but we don't know where we began, then it sort of leaves us floating. And things can get out of whack in our lives. Certainly things can get out of whack in our culture. Today, we want to pick up a topic that is just at the core of humanity. It is something that we spend so much of our time on, so much of our energy on. I mean, really, if you add up just the hours in a week or a month or really over the course of your life, we're going to talk about that thing that you absolutely give the heart of your life to today, and we're going to see that God has a design for it in the beginning. Of course, that thing I'm talking about today is our work, our working life. Most of us will spend more time vocationally working than we will do almost anything else, okay? If you take out the time that you sleep, your waking hours, what do you spend the most time on? Well, good news today, because what we're going to see is that thing that we spend our time and energy on in such a profound way is one of those things that God has designed and is right in our lives, right in the beginning. Okay, Tim Keller would say it like this: work is at the heart of things. It might shock you today. Maybe if you're a Christian, you haven't thought about this, or if you're kind of just coming in and this is one of your first times in a church, this may be kind of shocking to you to think about it like this. But you got to realize that before the Bible ever talks about prayer or going to church or preaching or reading the Bible, it talks about work. Before the Bible ever talks about anything in our lives or culture that just seems dominant, like sexuality or parenting or marriage or even Christian stuff like engaging the community or missions or going international or any of that stuff, before any of that is out there, the heartbeat of design is actually work. That God created us to be workers. This is far more foundational than we realize. To fit the analogy, though, here's what I want you to see. All of us sort of feel that is true in this sense. We feel like we need to work. We feel like we need to produce. We go to work every day. We feel the destination. But man, when you just look at our society, when you look at our culture, and all of us have been on both sides of this, man, we miss the working life that God designed in one of two ways, and we miss it pretty profoundly, and we do so because we have lost the starting place. We feel that we should work, we feel that it's important, but you know what ends up happening? We end up losing the starting place, and we end up kind of falling off of one side of the horse or the other. Maybe you don't understand that analogy. We use this with our staff a lot. You ever seen a Western movie where you got a cowboy that's drunk, and he jumps up on the horse, and then he falls off on one side, and then he jumps up on the horse, and he falls off the other side? Okay, this is what happens with us so many times when we can't gain the center, when we lose a starting place. We either become a people who underwork on one side, reject work, work's a curse, I don't want to work, or we fall off on the other side and we can't get enough of it and we never stop, never quit, never disengage. It's just our whole life is consumed over here. Both of us have probably been on that paradigm. one side or the other. You ever been on one side of the horse or the other? I've been on both sides. I remember this when I was in college. Some of you know me very well. This is going to shock you, okay? When I was in college, I was employed for one day of my life by a company in the mall called Hollister, okay? I know, that's shocking, isn't it? I worked there for one day, and I'm going to tell you what side of the horse I was on, okay? I was like, work is a curse. God has cursed the world with work, and it is thorns and thistles and bad cologne, and this is what Hollister is. And that's sort of the side I was on. And maybe you've been on that side at some job in your life. Maybe that's where you're at right now. I've been on the other side of my life, other side of this as well, though, at times in my life when I couldn't get enough. This is how I know that we retain the destination, but we lose the starting place, when we have such wild, varying views on a subject like this. Some of us don't want to start working hard. We're fine with cheating a boss. We're fine with calling in sick, even though we're not, whatever. We're on that side. We don't want to start working hard. Others of us can't stop working hard, ever. And when you and here's the shocking thing. Both of those come from the same root. You realize that? They both come from losing the starting place. See, on the other side of the horse, some of us just can't stop. I read this article the other day. 55% of American workers left paid vacation days on the table last year. 658 million paid vacation days the American labor force left on the table, a full third of that. That's over 200 million days that cannot be rolled over into next year. They're just gone. And we as a collective society basically just said, I'd rather work than not work. I'd rather not take my time off. One side of the horse or the other. We hate it. It's cursed. I reject it. I can't get enough of it because it's basically my God. It's something that I use to define my value and define my meaning. The interesting thing is they both come from the same root. We want to recover the starting place and see where we should be. Let me give you the big point today that I'm going to be driving at the whole time, all right? What is that thing that's going to keep us in the center? We recover the starting place. This is what we're going to learn about work. As a people in God's image, we don't work for an identity. We work from one. We don't become the type of people who, because we've had a few failures in our working life, and I know that there are some people that could just be lazy. I know my audience, though, I don't think that's where we are. If you're the type of person that's on this one side of the horse, maybe it's because you've had a couple failures in your life, you felt rejection one or two times, and because work is so close to your identity, you would just say it's a curse and forget it. Or maybe you're on the other side today, and because you feel like work is God out there, it is defining you. It is the thing that is getting to tell you your worth and your value. So you always got to go, keep going harder, keep going harder, keep going harder. We don't have to be on either side of the fence. We can be in the middle. We can regain the starting place. And we can be a people who passionately pursue work because it's good, but we also don't have to give ourselves to it as if it's God. It's good, but it ain't God, okay? All right, let's dive in. We're going to be in Genesis 1 again, same verses that we've been in. We're talking about the image of God. All this stuff kind of stems from the same place. Let me read a passage in chapter 1, then one more passage in chapter 2 here in a minute. I'll explain some things, and then we're going to come out with three big turns, okay? The image of God, the design of man, and a new way forward. All right, let's dive in. Genesis chapter 1, here's what it says, verse 26. God said, let us make man in our image. Very important. We're in the image of God. After our likeness, we favor him. We are like him. And let them have dominion over the fish of the sea and over the birds of the heavens and over the livestock and over all the earth and over every creeping thing that creeps on the earth. So God created man in his own image. In the image of God, he created him. Male and female, he created them. If you're newer with us, you remember that term man is the word Adam, but it doesn't mean Adam in a proper way. It means mankind. So what he's saying is male and female, the image of God, equally distributed between the sexes, male and female are created here, verse 28, and God blessed them and said to them, be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth and subdue the earth. Okay, fruitful, subdue, and have dominion. That's the third thing, over the fish of the sea and over the birds of the heavens and over every living thing that moves on the earth. I want to talk to you for just a minute as we're going to make sure we understand about these three things that we're told to do. Fill the earth, subdue the earth, and have dominion over the earth. Now, what I want you to see first, before I get into the actual words, okay, is that the things that we are called to do as humans actually stem from who we are. I'm going to explain this, but here's how I would say it. God commands actions that are in line with our humanity. Okay, what I mean by that is there is a design to humanity, and then there is a command to humanity. We are created in a certain way, and then we are commanded to be in the way that we are created. Now, that's a little bit odd, isn't it? God creates a dog, but he don't command it to bark. It barks because it's a dog, you see? God creates a bird, but it doesn't have a command to fly. It flies because it's a bird. It's created, not necessarily commanded, but humans are created and commanded. Why? Well, this is just, I'm giving you a shot across the bow about what's coming. Because we are creating a certain way, but because of the way we are created, we are the only ones that have the capacity to rebel. And so we are created and commanded. But at the core of humanity, we are created and commanded, and we're created and commanded to do a few things here. They all kind of mean the same thing, but they all have their nuances. The first one is that we are created to fill the earth, okay? That means exactly what you think it means. It means have a lot of babies, all right? That's what it means. And a lot of you guys in here are like, man, you got 12 sermons in this series. You can at least preach one full sermon on filling the earth. And I'm not going to do that today, okay? But I understand where you're going with that. What filling the earth is something that we see from Genesis 1. Humans were called to make more of God's children. Now, you might be a college student or single here today, and you're like, well, that doesn't apply to me at all. If you're a Christian, it applies to you totally. And the reason is because what did Jesus tell us in the New Testament? It's the same thing. When Jesus said, go and make disciples of all nations, we are still people who go about the world making spiritual children. This has changed a little bit in the New Testament, but it's the same idea. Fill the earth with the glory of God by little spiritual babies running around, okay? So fill the earth, but then it says subdue the earth, bring it under subjugation if you want to use that type of language. It's really getting into the idea of tilling and working. We're going to see that again in Genesis 2. And then it says, thirdly, to have dominion over. And we talked about that, being a good ruler, like a good king that rules over a people, but rules them well and is generous and is to the delight of the people that would glorify him and just be so excited about that type of king. That's the type of dominion that we are supposed to have over the earth. Now, what do these things, when you take them together, mean? Fill the earth, subdue, dominion. Here's what they mean. We are called to create with God's creation. So I would say it like this. God's creation was formed, but it was not finished. It needed development, and that is where humanity comes in. We are, at the core of who we are, humans, who are made in the image of God, who he has created and commanded to be cultivators, to be creators, to be shapers. The wonder of creation is that through cultivation, we would bring out more wonder in creation. Okay, I know that one's not on the screen. Maybe it should have been. The wonder of creation is that we would be cultivating the creation and bringing out more wonder. That is where God is most glorified, that he didn't just create this painting that is static. He created the world that continues to create and bring out beauty, and that is what humans are supposed to do. I think the analogy we use a lot of times, you hear people say, hey, we're like the hands of God in the world. And I think that's fine if you want to use that analogy. Maybe a better analogy is like, no, we're like the gloves of God in the world, that his hand is in, he is working, and we are working. Psalm 127, one of my favorite verses, Psalm 127, 1, here's what it says. It's the Lord who builds the house. He said, the labors of man are in vain if God isn't the one who builds the house. Well, wait a minute. Man labors, but God builds. And the answer is yes. We labor, we work, we cultivate, we shape, but it is God moving and working through us. And he is working through us to bring about a glorious end. You know, I said in a few weeks ago when we talked about creation care, that creation care is not always the same thing as conservation. That's what people think. They think creation care means like leave it alone. No. We're putting a garden. A garden isn't left alone. There's nothing about a garden that is left alone. It is all shaped and cared for, and the world is that way. Listen, man starts in a garden, but we end in Revelation with what coming down? It's not another garden that comes down. It's a city that comes down. The whole world is moving as humans create, shape, and cultivate from a garden to a beautiful city that is full of culture, that is full of work, we're gonna see that today, that is full of all of these things that God intended for this world in the beginning. You know, this is just a little bit of an aside, but I want us to see this. Part of what we do in being a shaper and being a cultivator and being in God's image to create and to be ones who fill the earth and subdue the earth and have dominion over the earth, part of what that means, part of cultivating creation is creating culture, okay? That's what it means. We are one, and what is culture? I'm gonna give you a quick definition of culture. Many of us think about culture in a lot of different ways. Culture is what happens. It is the byproduct of humans interacting with creation. So let me give a few examples of that. When I say culture, some of you would think about, well, you mean like high culture, like Beethoven or something. Or you mean like, no, it's like a pop song on the radio that's probably horrific, you know, but it's both like culture. Or maybe you're thinking about some type of art that you have seen or it's high culture. Maybe some of you, when I say culture, you think about where you're from. You're like, man, we're from the South. Summer starts in April. Mac and cheese is a vegetable. Sweet tea. This is where we're from. It's the South. Some of you are from the North. The rest of us, very sorry for you about that. Okay, but we're all from different. I'm just kidding. We're all from different places. And you're like, man, that we all have our different cultures. I thought it was so funny. One of the college students is close to our family, close to our kids. I heard her and my little daughter having a conversation. She's this college student is from the Midwest, and she's telling my daughter all of these different words that they use for things. Hattie Jo just thinks it's the funniest thing in the world. Like, why do they talk like this? Why do they say these things about or what? All of that kind of stuff, the nuances, the dialect, maybe you think food, all of that is fine. It's all part of God's creation that creates that we are ones who bring wonder out of what is already wonderful. Dialect, styles of music, architecture, economics, politics, it is all us working with creation that produces these things. I'm gonna talk about this in just a minute, but just so you don't misunderstand. I understand that a lot of this stuff is taken in a bad direction. Okay, we're gonna talk about that. But structurally, the idea of the categories that God has created within humanity to give us the ability to create architecture and even politics and economics and art and all of these things, this is all structurally good. I know we take it directionally bad because we're sinful. We're going to talk about that. But structurally, it's good, and it was the design. The wonder of creation is that more wonder would be drawn out of creation through humanity. I want you to flip to chapter 2. We're going to read one more verse together that kind of hits on the same thing. But I want to continue to get into the language here to really teach this. And make sure we understand. Genesis 2:15 says this: the Lord God took the man and put him in the Garden of Eden, two phrases here, to work it and to keep it, okay? He's placed in the garden, and then he is told to work it and to keep it. Now, there are a couple things I want you to see. The first thing is this, it's a little bit of an aside, all right? I understand that, and then we're gonna get back to the heart of things. But here's what I want you to see in this phrase, that God put man in the garden. Now, I don't want you to get tripped up. I'm gonna deal with this in a couple weeks. Does Genesis 1 not match Genesis 2? It said he created the male and female, and now all of a sudden it's saying there's just man that is in the garden, and Eve is gonna be created later. We're gonna talk about that. Just suspend that for a minute. I'm not glossing over it, but it's not the focus of the message right now. Genesis 2, man, Adam, is placed in the garden, and the language there, other places in the Old Testament, is used really to kind of say as placed as a guardian over the garden, that he guards the sanctity of the garden. I think this is something that absolutely applies to both of us, both sexes that are in the room. I fully understand that. But I want to talk to the men in the room for just a minute and ask you this question. Are we guarding that part of creation that God gave to us? And some of you, when I begin to talk with language about guarding, are you watching the door? That man part of you just begins to come out. And you say, yes, I guard my house. I choose who comes in and is around my kids. I choose what we do in terms of security, and we have an alarm system and I lock the doors. And some of you would say, I am ready for anything. I've got security, dog, guns, whatever it is, I am ready, okay? But I got one question for you. Are you watching the door while you're leaving the window wide open to the one that actually wants to come in and steal, kill, and destroy? And what I mean is I hear men talk real tough about what they would do if somebody tried to rob their house and they locked the door, and all the while they got every single window in the house wide open, spiritually speaking. They're letting anger just fester in their house. That they're allowing lust to just run wild even though they got boys and that are coming up to be teenagers in their home. I mean, all of these things. And we want to be macho about guarding the house. That's fine. Guard that piece of creation physically that God has given you. But don't watch the door while you're leaving the window wide open to the actual robber that wants to come in and break up your family and steal your kids and destroy your marriage. Don't leave the windows wide open for that. Be a guardian over that part of creation that God has entrusted to you. But that's sort of an aside. I think what this is really getting at here a little more, okay, if you're taking notes, is something like this. The language of working the garden and keeping the garden is really language that speaks to worship. And I'm gonna get there, okay? It's, you know, when I say worship, you're like, wait a minute, I thought worship was like what we just did. We sang, yes, that's a part of worship. But also worship is something that we do with our lives when we live in accordance with God's design. Living according to God's design is saying, God, I trust you. I trust that your design is good. And so when I am one who works and keeps and cultivates with and tries to be a human in the way that you have created me to be, then I am worshiping you. Now, the language here actually speaks to that. I want to show you two very interesting things, okay? What you end up having in verse 15 is this idea of working, all right? Now, in Hebrew, other places in the Old Testament, working the garden, that term working also means to worship. It means to serve God. So for example, in Exodus chapter 3, verse 12, you can go look it up. It's the same verbiage that's used. When the scripture says, you will serve God on this mountain, it could have easily be translated work for God. So working and serving, worshiping, it has sort of the same idea. Further than that, the next phrase, to keep, to take care of, it also has a worshiping kind of connotation to it. You think about where else the language is used in the Old Testament. Take care of the garden. You know who else was told to take care of? The priests were told to take care of, same verb, the temple. It's a worshiping type of language. I know men that are, there's scholars that I would trust, the school that I came out of, that actually would take this passage and translate it and say, I think the most accurate translation is that man was put in the garden not to work and keep, but to worship and obey. You would say, well, which translation do I pick? I think the fact that we're asking the question speaks to the truth. The fact that what we're saying is to work and to keep is to worship and obey, because we are created to work and to keep. We are created in the image of God to be ones who are workers that take creation and cultivate it and shape it and work with it, all right? I told you there were three big turns that I wanted to take. Let me give them to you again. Okay, the image of God, design of man, and the third one is going to be the new way forward. The first one is this, the image of God. Y'all, this will come up, I know, over and over again. You say, man, doesn't it seems like it's all going back to the image of God. Yes, that's the starting place. That's where we gotta go back to. That's the part that we have lost. We have to understand who God is before we can understand who we are, because we are in his image. We are in his likeness. We favor him. So it begs the question, we have to begin with, well, what does God look like in terms of work? And what we realize is this, that in God's image, we are workers because God is a worker. We are workers because God is a worker. That might be surprising to you when you think about other creation accounts. For example, the Mesopotamian creation accounts, where you have something like this. You know, we work because God's a worker and he made us to be in his image, like him. We have other creation accounts during this time that would come out that might even be aligned with more of the way that you think on a day-to-day basis, where they would say, no, work is bad. So their creation accounts were that the gods didn't want to work, and so they created humans to do all the work. So humans do all the work, and then they don't have to work at all, and they can just kind of be up in the heavens doing leisure all day, and they don't have to work. That's not the God that we serve. Some of you might think that. You might think, well, work is cursed. We have to work. God doesn't work. What we realize here is that God is a worker, that before there was even humanity, God was working. We are in his image. We are in the image of a worker God. Now, what do we learn about this? Okay, what does this teach us in a very practical way? Let me get super practical for just a minute. What does it teach us practically if God is a working God? If it's not something that he disdains, but that he takes pleasure in. Remember, he said it was good. Every time he did something, it's good. He takes delight in his work. What does it mean for us? It means two things. The first thing it means is this, that God doesn't elevate the spiritual over the physical. That's the first thing that it means. That many of us, in a form of dualism, okay, we end up saying, well, spirit good, physical work, physical anything, bad. If it's in the creation, it's bad. If it's not spiritual, it's got to be spiritual to have any value at all. That's not biblical. What's biblical is God created the spiritual and the physical together and both held them up and said, this is good. Some of you in this room might have grown up in a tradition where you thought this is what was taught to your whole life. Praying good, preaching good, reading the Bible, good, music good, as long as it says the word Jesus, okay? Sex, bad. No matter what, all times, bad. Theater, movies, very bad, okay? Maybe some of you grew up in a tradition like this. Dr. Bruce Ashford from Southeastern Seminary, his book called Every Square Inch on this subject. He grew up in Eastern North Carolina. He grew up in the tradition that I'm talking about. He said this, when I was growing up, I didn't know anything about art, but I knew it was bad, okay? And I think about that, and I think about, man, that's a tradition that some of us come from, where the spiritual is lifted up and everything that is physical, everything that God made is so bad and so dirty. And what that does is it says, listen, I know that directionally a lot of these things are bad because we take them in a bad direction, but structurally everything that I have named, sexuality, art, food, I mean, everything that you name, think about everything that was in the garden. Structurally, it is all good. We should not call it bad. Think about music for an example. I know that some people can take music in a very bad direction, but the fact of God making music, that's actually good. It's not bad just because it's structurally good, even though it can be directionally bad. In the original creation, all I'm trying to get you to see is that work is in that category of structurally being a good thing. It's not a bad thing. It's not, oh, it's out in the world, so it's bad. Spiritual praying is good. That's a false dichotomy. That's dualism. That's not Christianity. The second practical thing that we learn here about the image of God, that he is a worker, is this, that work is not the result of sin, therefore it should not be avoided. And some of you right here are in this where you think, well, sin wrecked the world and therefore we have to work. And what we don't realize is, no. Work is good. It has always been good. It was there before humans came and wrecked anything. Work is a good thing. And you know what? You actually know this even though you don't know it, because you might think your job is a curse. Maybe some of you guys, you hate your job. It's a curse. You don't like your job, but you love to work in the yard at home or something like that, right? Maybe some of us in the room, our work, man, we hate our job, but we love to create art, or we love to do something that is crafty, or we love to work on the house in a certain way and to paint rooms and bring order to creation. That is work. It is work. Now, you might think about it like that. You're not getting paid or whatever. It's still work. It is us interacting with creation. And it's a good thing, and we know that it's a good thing. Well, God engaged in work. So we know that it's not something that is to be avoided for us. Man, I hope that some of you today, maybe that's the one thing that you need to hear in this message. Maybe the one thing you need to see is this. Maybe the job that you're in is not your passion. Maybe you feel like you're overqualified and underemployed. Maybe you feel like you're not getting paid. Maybe your boss is just a jerk. Maybe they're just a hard person to work with. I don't know what it is, but anything that brings you to the conclusion that what you do tomorrow when you wake up and you're 9 to 5 is cursed is not biblical. I'm not saying that you shouldn't go try to change your situation, okay? Man, you go, man, better yourself, go change your situation if you need to do that, but don't think about it being a curse tomorrow that you have to go work is a good thing from God, okay? And obviously, if you're in some kind of organized crime ring, throw out everything I just said, all right? I'm talking about general jobs like most of us have, all right? Second thing is this, the design of humanity. I wanted to harp on the image of God because we are in the image of God. We are in his likeness. We favor him, in other words. So however he is, that's how we are. We serve a God who works. He worked before sin in paradise, gave us work to do before sin in paradise. It is that God that designed us in his image and his likeness. All I'm trying to, and I've worked to think, okay, how can I say this the best way? This is so simple, but I think this is the best way to say it. Many of us think about work as if it's the activities that we go and do in our 9 to 5 every day. That's just not true. This is what I'm trying to say. We are workers by God's design. That's what I'm trying to say. We are workers. It's not something we do. It is integral to who we are. The dog barks, the bird flies, humans work. It is what we are created and commanded to do. We favor the one who works. I'm always amused by like when we have our kids, because people always do this. I do this too. You look at a child and you're trying to place them with the mother or father. Like, man, they kind of look like you. They kind of look like you. And our two older ones sort of, people be like, oh, that one looks like Hey Joe, or that one looks like Anna, or that one looks like you. Then they see our third child, who's the largest kid in the state of North Carolina. And they're like, where did he come from, right? But they're always trying to make those connections. Why? Because we assume that whoever we come from, that we will favor them. And all this is saying, all I'm trying to get you to see is that God is a worker God and we are worker people. If you're skeptical in the room today, maybe, and we've had skeptical kind of skeptics coming in like, man, I don't, but this is an intriguing sermon series for some of you. One of those things that I would call out that's sort of a pull in your heart, that's sort of an echo in your heart, why I think that I would say I think you know that what I'm saying is right, is because you have such an innate pull to be purposeful and to work and to shape things and to bring order out of chaos. And you might say, well, evolution teaches me that because I need to, you know, do that in order to get by. You know what? There are plenty of people in this world that don't need to work another day in their life because their needs are totally met and totally taken care of. And they're going to wake up that next day and they're going to feel that pull. You know why? Because they're created to. They're designed that way. It is part of who we are. We have an innate desire to shape things. Some of you are teachers. You want to shape the minds of your students. Some of you have at work, you want to shape the numbers of a dismal performance in the sales division. You want to shape that. Some of you come in and you think, man, I think about our college students. A lot of them are gone this weekend, but I think about it and I think, why do you have the innate desire to take all of these sources that are spread out all over your dorm room and to pull them into one cohesive thought and paper that you can turn in and get an A on? Why do we have that pull inside of us? It is because we are created to work. You know, my father works with kids that have special needs. He's been doing this for a while now. And one of the things that has been kind of in vogue recently, I don't know how recent, maybe even go back a couple decades, is that people are realizing that in these kids, the greatest thing they can give them is vocational skills. Why? Because they need to be taken care of and meet their needs? Probably not. Either their parents are going to meet their needs and maybe have to do that the rest of their life. If not, our government is certainly going to do that. It's not that they're not going to have their needs met. It's not about them meeting needs physically. It's that there's a need that is deep inside of them to be productive. And people are realizing, man, this is the best thing we can give them. And because we are created this way. We are designed this way. The problem is this. The problem with humanity is that we reject the design and we reject it on one side or the other, all right? And this is getting all the way back to the intro. We reject the design. On one side, we hate work as if it wasn't created by God, okay? That's on this side over here. And that's where some of us might be today. Man, how do I see this? I'll give you two extremes, 18 and 80, okay? Now, where I would think about a college student or somebody that's maybe retired or about to retire. Let me give you two extremes. You disdain work equally when you kind of do these things. Maybe a college student comes out of getting their degree and they have plenty of job offers on the table, but they're not one that is technically in their field. And so rather than work, they just don't work. Maybe for months. Is that okay? Is that right? No. It's rejecting the design. It's saying like, God, I don't want, I was in a community group with a guy one time where he said, hey, I'm getting laid off from my job. But then I figured out that I can get unemployment and almost make the same amount of money. I've got another job on the table that I could take, but I'm not going to take it because unemployment will pay me. And I looked back at him and I said, where did you ever get the idea that work is about money? Who gave you that? Work is about your design. Work is about who you are. Work is about, you need to, I think about people that on the other side that are approaching retirement. I've seen people, I've got a guy in our community group, I feel like handles this the exact right way. Yes, retired. Does that mean they don't work? No, it doesn't mean that. It means that they get to work on their time. When they get tired, they go home, okay? But it doesn't mean that they're just not gonna do it. People have thought about, oh, I'm gonna retire and I'm just gonna leisure. For 30 years, you can only take leisure in measure. It's against your design. We work 6 days. You know, and rest. You try to leisure for 30 years and you see how that works out for you. How many of us have known something or seen a story somewhere where somebody won millions in the lottery and 3 years later, their life is an absolute train wreck? Why? Because they tried to embrace leisure, leave work, and they forgot the fact that work is part of your design. I'm not saying you're approaching retirement. I'm not saying your work don't change. I'm not saying you don't go do something with the rest of your life that you've wanted to do your whole life. But man, to think about, hey, I'm just done and I'm not going to be productive and produce anymore, whether that be in a nonprofit way or a church way or even for, if you're just going to stop, you reject the design. Of course, the other side of the horse is this. The other side that we fall off of is this. We love work too much. It has become our God like anything else. We take a good thing from God and then we replace God with it. And we chase it with our life and we say, this thing is strong enough for me to build my identity on and I'm gonna be who it tells me that I am. And if I do a really good job, that's gonna make me know that I'm okay. It's gonna make me know that I'm worth something in this world and therefore we end up bowing down before it. And we chase it as if it is God. We chase the things that gives us money, security, status. Instead of praising God for what he has given us, we take it and we say, I'll replace you with it. It will sit on the throne of my life and I will chase it forever. We can't fall off either side of the horse. We are created in God's image. The design of man is to work, but not rejecting the design on one side and saying, I hate it, not rejecting it on the other side and saying, it is my God. We need a new way forward. Let me close with this. The new way forward. Some of us underwork, some of us overwork, but what's the answer? Some of us are on the side over here where we're fine with calling in sick even though we ain't sick. And then others of us are on the other side over here, where even though we are sick, we have that super driven, I'm going to be a CEO one day, that I don't care. I'll drive my health and my family into the ground because I am pursuing this as if it is God. In both cases, we are rejecting our identity. They come back to the same root. They come back to having lost the starting place. If we reject the starting place, which is God has created us to be his children, and in his image we go work. If we reject that design on either side, we will become a people who decide to go out and try to build an identity on our own. And you know what? Work will become a great candidate for that, because we get a lot of praise from it when we do a good job, or we can hate on it when we don't. Here's what I want you to see. Your work can never tell you who you are. It is not God, okay? It's not God. It doesn't get to dictate to you who you are, but there is a God in heaven, and I want you to understand what he declares over you and what he says about you. We miss so much in so many ways. We sin, we're guilty. God still loves us, he cares. One of those ways that we miss it all the time is in our working life. Some of you underwork and you cheat your boss. Others of you overwork and you cheat your families, because even though you come home, you are not mentally engaged with them. You are still at work all day. Work is a major problem for us. So Jesus has come to work, okay? Work is a problem for us. So Jesus Christ, the second Adam, has come to fix what the first Adam broke for us and what every one of us has fallen into. Jesus has come to work for us, and this was his work on our behalf. He decided to live a life that we didn't live and die a death that we deserved. In the places that we have failed in our working lives, underworking here, overworking there, we deserve before God, who is righteous and holy, who has never sinned at all. When we sin before him, we deserve death and we deserve exile, but Jesus took both so that we would have neither. This is the work that Jesus has come to do on our behalf. And through faith in this gospel, we can recover the identity that we lost. Some of you have been building your identity on a working life. And you know what that means? You are walking around today feeling like the biggest failure on earth. You have a weight that is around your neck that is just speaking in your ear. You failed, you're broken, you can't hack it. That is not who you are, because work doesn't get to tell you who you are. Others of you on the other side, you think you are maybe even smug, prideful. I don't need God. Why? Because work is speaking some great things to me right now and I'm succeeding. And you know what? One day you're gonna get old and you're not gonna be able to work anymore, or one day you're gonna die and you're not gonna be able to work anymore. And it will not have been a sufficient stronghold God to build your identity on. It will fail you. So we need a new way forward. And the new way forward is the gospel. How freeing is this statement? Let me ask you a question. How freeing is this? All right, listen to the statement. There is no amount of work that you could fail in that changes anything about actually who you are. And there is no amount of work that you could succeed in tomorrow that changes who you are. You do not work for an identity. You work from an identity, and that identity is you are a child of God. So what do? Where do we go? Here's where we go. Dietrich Bonhoeffer said this, I love this. The Christian hope, it sends man back to his life on earth in a new way. That's interesting, because you would think the Christian hope sends you off into the clouds thinking about heaven, right? No. What Bonhoeffer said is the Christian hope, I mean, it does that, but it sends you back to your real world life. It just sends you back to that in a brand new way. You don't got to think about heaven as you leave here. You can think about your 9-to-5 tomorrow in a different way. How does this change the way that we work? The two words I would characterize and sum all of this up is this. You don't have to be apathetic about your job tomorrow, and you don't have to be anxious about your job tomorrow. If it's God to you, you're going to be anxious about it, because it could leave you in a second. That's very scary. And it will produce tons of worry and anxiety in our life. You also don't have to be apathetic about it. I've been on both sides of those. I've been pretty apathetic, like when I was working at Hollister, okay? And I've been on the other side when I was planting this church. About for the first 2 years, you move your whole family, you take a shot, you do all this kind of stuff, you leave what is comfortable. And for a couple of years, there can be some anxiety in that, and it was sin. It's like, hey, serving God is like what I'm trying to do, but actually the serving part has become God when I'm that worried about it. I've been on both sides. We've all been on both sides of this, is all I'm saying. But we don't have to be on both sides of it anymore. Your identity is in the gospel. Your identity is a child of God. Now let's go and work from that identity tomorrow, all right? Let's pray. Father, we come before you today, and God, I just pray for both groups of people that are in the room. Lord, if there are those that are here today that are skeptical, that are just kind of checking Christianity out, Lord, I pray that maybe this sermon would drive them to look for answers inside of themselves about why they are the way they are. God, we all look to shape things. We all feel the desire to be purposeful, even if our needs are totally met. Never goes away. It's because we're in your image. God, I pray for those of us in the room that are believers that want to live in a new way tomorrow, that want to attack our 9-to-5, not because it's God, but because it is good. It is structurally good. Lord, for those in the room that are feeling apathy about what they do tomorrow when they go to work, Lord, I pray that you would allow them to see the value in it, that you have created them to be a worker and you've created the physical to be good. God, they would see and have a high view of it. Father, I pray on the other side, those of us maybe working so much that we have great anxiety about our job. We have great anxiety about the things that we have to do tomorrow. Lord, I pray we would realize it doesn't get to define us. It doesn't get to tell us who we are. We are not these jobs. We are not performance-based. God, you have given us an identity off of Jesus' performance. In Christ's name we pray, amen.